A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one while he's literally pushing boxes around his apartment. And honestly, it's the kind of question that only hits you when you're surrounded by stacks of your own belongings. You're on the 12th floor. You've got hundreds of pounds of books and furniture piled up, and you suddenly realize there are maybe a dozen other apartments above you doing the exact same thing. Hundreds of tons of weight, all resting on what, 6 inches of concrete between you and the ceiling? Why doesn't the whole thing just punch through?
That's the question that's been keeping structural engineers employed for about 2,000 years. And the short answer is that there's an invisible skeleton inside every building, a carefully designed path that every single pound of weight follows, from your moving boxes all the way down to the bedrock. It's not magic, but it's also not obvious unless you know what to look for.
That's what we're tracing today. The gravity load path, from the rebar in your floor slab, through the beams and columns, into the foundation, and eventually into the ground itself. Along the way, we'll talk about why concrete and steel are basically the greatest odd couple partnership in engineering history, what actually happens to old concrete buildings over decades, and whether mass timber and other alternatives are finally ready to challenge concrete's dominance.
Let's start with the most basic question. How does a concrete floor slab actually hold up a room full of furniture and people?
Because on the face of it, concrete seems like the wrong material for the job. It's heavy, it's brittle, and if you take a slab of it and try to bend it, it snaps almost immediately.
And that's the core puzzle. Concrete is phenomenal at handling compression. You can stack enormous weight on top of it, and it just sits there, unbothered. Standard structural concrete has a compressive strength of about 4,000 pounds per square inch. That means a 1-inch square column of concrete can hold up a small car before it crushes. But if you pull on it, try to stretch it, or bend it. The tensile strength is only about 400 psi, roughly 1/10 of its compressive strength. So if you take a concrete beam and put weight on it, the bottom of the beam is in tension. It's being pulled apart. And concrete alone can't handle that. It cracks, and once it cracks, the whole thing fails.
Which is where the steel comes in.
Steel rebar is embedded in the concrete, specifically on the tension side, the bottom of a beam, the underside of a floor slab. Steel has enormous tensile strength, something like 60,000 psi for typical rebar. So when the concrete tries to crack under tension, the steel carries the load instead.
Here's the part that I find genuinely elegant. These two materials expand and contract at almost exactly the same rate when the temperature changes. The coefficient of thermal expansion for both steel and concrete is about 12 times 10 to the negative 6th per degree Celsius. If they expanded at different rates, they'd tear each other apart over a few summers and winters.
That's the detail that makes the whole partnership work. It's not just that steel is strong and concrete is cheap, it's that they're thermally compatible. If you embedded aluminum rebar in concrete, the aluminum would expand more than the concrete when it got hot, and the internal stresses would crack the concrete from the inside. The steel-concrete match is one of those happy coincidences in material science that shape the entire modern built environment.
The floor under your feet is a composite material. The concrete handles the downward compression from your furniture, and the rebar grid embedded near the bottom handles the tension that would otherwise crack the slab in half. Together they act like a single material that's strong in both directions.
That slab doesn't float in midair. It's supported by beams, also reinforced concrete, designed with the same compression-tension logic. The beams transfer the load to columns. The columns carry it down, floor by floor, accumulating weight as they go.
This is the gravity load path. Every pound in the building, every box of books, every refrigerator, every person standing in the hallway, follows a specific structural route. Floor slab to beams, beams to columns, columns to foundation, foundation to ground. If any single link in that chain fails, everything above it comes down.
That's not theoretical. In 1995, the Sampoom department store in Seoul collapsed, killing 502 people. The builder had reduced the column diameters from 80 centimeters to 60 centimeters, cutting their cross-sectional area nearly in half to save money on concrete. Then they added a heavy cooling tower on the roof, which the weakened columns weren't designed to support. The fifth floor slab gave way first, and then it was a progressive collapse. The fourth floor, the third, the second, all the way down.
502 people. Because someone decided to shave 20 centimeters off a column.
That's what makes the gravity load path so unforgiving. There's no redundancy in the way loads travel downward. If a column fails, everything that column was supporting has nowhere else to go. Unlike a suspension bridge where cables can redistribute load if one fails, a column in a building is a single point of failure for its entire tributary area.
Let's talk about that accumulation. On the 40th floor of a skyscraper, a column only has to support the weight of whatever's directly above it on that one floor. But by the time you reach the ground floor, that same column is carrying the cumulative weight of 40 floors.
It's like a pyramid of load, but inverted. At the top, the column is narrow because the load is light. At the bottom, it's massive, sometimes several feet across, because it's supporting the entire vertical stack. Same concrete, same steel, just more cross-sectional area to distribute the force. That's a common misconception, that skyscrapers need exotic alloys for the lower columns. They just need more square inches of the same stuff. The compressive stress on the concrete at the base of a well-designed skyscraper is actually about the same as on a column in a 10-story building. The column is wider, so the force per unit area stays constant.
There's another wrinkle here that most people never think about. Column shortening. Under load, concrete columns compress elastically. Not much. Maybe 1 to 2 millimeters per floor, but it adds up. Over 80 floors, there could be 6 or 7 inches of total compression at the top.
If you don't account for that during construction, you get problems. The interior columns, which carry more weight than the exterior ones, compress more. If you pour all the floor slabs perfectly level, the building settles unevenly. The middle sinks slightly relative to the edges, and you get cracks in the walls and floors. Engineers have to calculate the expected shortening in advance and pour the column slightly taller to compensate so that once the full dead load is applied, everything settles into level.
That's the kind of detail that makes me appreciate how much invisible engineering goes into a building that just looks. Every floor you walk on was deliberately built slightly out of level because the engineers knew it would settle into place.
Then there's the foundation. All that accumulated weight. Millions of pounds concentrated in a few dozen columns eventually has to transfer into the ground. You can't just rest a column on dirt and hope for the best. Soil has a bearing capacity, the maximum pressure it can support without failing. For competent soil, that's typically 2,000 to 6,000 pounds per square foot. Which sounds like a lot, until you realize a single column at the base of a skyscraper might be carrying 10 million pounds. If that column sat directly on the ground, it would punch through like a stiletto heel on wet grass.
You spread the load.
A spread footing is basically a concrete pad at the base of the column that's much wider than the column itself, sometimes 10 to 20 times the cross-sectional area. It takes that 10 million pounds and distributes it over enough square feet that the pressure drops below the soil's bearing capacity. For really heavy buildings or poor soil conditions, you use piles. Long concrete or steel shafts driven deep into the ground until they hit bedrock or find enough friction to support the load. The Burj Khalifa is the extreme example. 192 piles, each 1.5 meters in diameter, drilled 50 meters deep. The total weight of the building is about 500,000 tons, and the foundation spreads that across an area roughly the size of a football field.
Which brings us back to Daniel, pushing boxes around his apartment, wondering why the floor doesn't buckle. The answer is that someone calculated exactly how much weight that floor would need to hold, added a safety factor, designed the rebar spacing and concrete thickness accordingly, and then someone else inspected it to make sure it was built right. It's not magic. It's math and materials, science and a century of trial and error. Some of it catastrophic.
It's worth pausing on that partnership for a moment because it's one of the great unsung inventions of the modern world. Reinforced concrete was patented in the 1850s by a French gardener named Joseph Monnier, who was trying to build better flower pots. He embedded iron mesh in concrete and realized the combination was far stronger than either material alone.
Flower pots to skyscrapers. That's quite a career arc for a material.
The principle hasn't changed. Concrete provides the compressive backbone, steel rebar provides the tensile skeleton, and together they create what engineers call composite action. The two materials don't just sit next to each other, they're bonded. The ridges on the rebar grip the concrete, so when the concrete tries to crack under tension, the load transfers directly into the steel. They strain together as a single unit.
The key insight is that the load path is a chain, a literal chain, in the weakest link sense. You can have the most brilliantly designed floor slab in the world, but if the beam supporting it is undersized, the slab is irrelevant. You can have perfect beams and columns, but if the foundation settles unevenly, the whole structure twists and cracks.
That's why structural engineers talk about following the load to ground. Every design decision starts at the roof and works downward, accumulating weight at each level, making sure every element can handle what's being asked of it, plus the safety factor, typically around 1.6 for both dead and live loads in most building codes.
The live load being people, furniture, moving boxes, the dead load being the weight of the building itself, and in a tall building, the dead load dwarfs the live load. A typical floor slab weighs about 50 to 80 pounds per square foot just by itself. Your furniture adds maybe 10 to 15 pounds on top of that. The building is mostly holding itself up.
Which is why the lower floors aren't some heroic piece of engineering that's barely hanging on. The column at the ground floor of a 40-story tower is sized precisely for the load it will carry, with a comfortable margin. The concrete isn't stressed anywhere near its failure point.
Here's why all of this matters right now. Beyond satisfying Daniel's curiosity, we're in the middle of a global construction boom, the equivalent of adding an entire New York City to the planet every month for the next few decades, according to some estimates. And concrete is the backbone of all of it. Cement production accounts for roughly 8% of global carbon dioxide emissions. That's more than the entire aviation industry.
Understanding how buildings actually work isn't just an intellectual exercise. If we want to build greener, we need to understand what concrete does and why it's so hard to replace. You can't redesign a system you don't understand. The gravity load path tells you where the forces go. Composite action tells you why concrete and steel work together. And once you grasp those two concepts, you can start asking the right questions about alternatives. Can mass timber handle the same loads? Can geopolymer concrete provide the same durability? What would it actually take to build a 40-story tower without Portland cement?
Those are exactly the questions we're going to dig into next.
We've established that concrete and steel work together, and that every pound follows a path to the ground. But let's get into the numbers. I mentioned that concrete handles about 4,000 psi in compression, but only about 400 in tension. That 10-to-1 ratio is the entire reason rebar exists. You can't just use more concrete to solve the tension problem. Making the beam thicker adds weight, which increases the bending forces. It's a losing spiral. The physics of bending means the tension force in a beam increases with the square of the span. Double the distance between columns, and the tension forces quadruple. The steel isn't optional. It's what makes the geometry work.
That thermal compatibility. The 12 times 10 to the negative 6 per degree Celsius expansion rate for both materials? That's not just a nice coincidence. It's the reason reinforced concrete doesn't self-destruct after a few seasons. If the rates were different by even 20%, a 100-degree temperature swing would generate internal stresses that could crack the concrete around every piece of rebar. You'd get microfractures at the bond interface, water would seep in, the steel would rust, and the whole thing would start failing within a decade.
Let's follow the load downward. You've got your floor slab working as a composite, concrete and compression on top, rebar and tension on the bottom. That slab transfers weight to the beams. The beams transfer to the columns. And now we hit the part that Daniel was really asking about, how the lower floors don't just get crushed. The answer is deceptively simple. They get bigger. A column on the 40th floor might be 12 inches square, supporting maybe 20 or 30,000 pounds. That same column at ground level might be 4 feet square, 16 times the cross-sectional area, because it's carrying the accumulated weight of all 40 floors above it. The stress on the concrete stays roughly constant all the way down. You just keep adding square inches.
which brings us to column shortening. Under that enormous compressive load, concrete columns actually get shorter. Not much. About 1 to 2 millimeters per floor. But in a 100-story building, that's up to 8 inches of total compression by the time you reach the top.
If you don't plan for it, the building tears itself apart. The interior columns typically carry more weight than the exterior ones, so they compress more. If you pour every floor perfectly level during construction, the middle of the building ends up lower than the edges once the full dead load is applied. That differential settlement creates shear forces in the floor slabs and cracks in the walls. So the engineers pour the interior column slightly taller, building a deliberate hump into each floor, knowing it'll settle flat once the weight is on.
All of which eventually reaches the foundation. You've got a single column carrying 10 million pounds, and it's sitting on dirt. Good, compacted soil can handle about 2,000 to 6,000 pounds per square foot before it fails. A column base might be 4 square feet. 10 million pounds divided by 4 square feet is 2.5 million pounds per square foot, about 1,000 times what the soil can handle. Without a foundation, that column would punch through the ground like a nail through cardboard.
You spread the load. A spread footing widens the column into a concrete pad that might be 20 times the column's area. And when the soil is poor or the loads are enormous, you go deeper with pile foundations that bypass the weak surface soil entirely. The Burj Khalifa is the extreme case. 192 piles, each 1.5 meters in diameter, drilled 50 meters deep, spreading 500,000 tons across an area the size of a football field.
Which is the opposite of the Sampong department store. That building collapsed because someone cut the columns from 80 centimeters to 60, reducing their cross-sectional area by nearly half, and then added a heavy cooling tower on the roof. 502 people died because the load bath was broken at its most critical point.
The collapse was progressive. The fifth floor slab failed first, then the fourth, then the third, each floor adding its weight to the falling mass, punching through the floor below like a piston. The entire gravity load path unraveled in seconds. That's what makes the load path so unforgiving. In a building column, there's no backup. Everything above that column has only one route to the ground.
The answer to Daniel's question, why don't buildings collapse more often, is that the load path is designed, calculated, inspected, and overbuilt at every single link. The rebar spacing in your floor slab, the column dimensions tapering down the building, the footing spreading the load into the soil. Every one of those decisions was made deliberately, with safety factors baked in.
That's how buildings go up and stay up. But what happens over decades? Daniel mentioned concrete seems almost immortal, and that's a reasonable thing to think when you're standing in a building that's been there your whole life. But the immortality of concrete is one of the great myths of modern construction. Modern Portland cement concrete has a design life of 50 to 100 years. After that, things start happening at the chemical level. The concrete slowly absorbs carbon dioxide from the air, a process called carbonation, and that lowers the pH around the rebar. The alkaline environment is what protects steel from rusting, so once the pH drops, the rebar is vulnerable.
Once the rebar starts rusting, it's not just a surface problem.
Rust occupies 2 to 4 times the volume of the original steel. So a piece of rebar that was half an inch thick swells as it corrodes, creating enormous internal pressure. The concrete can't stretch to accommodate it. Remember, it has almost no tensile strength, so it cracks from the inside out. Chunks of concrete start falling off. That's spalling. And once the rebar is exposed to air and moisture directly, the corrosion accelerates. Salt water is concrete's nemesis. Chloride ions from seawater or road salt penetrate the concrete and attack the rebar directly, even if the concrete hasn't fully carbonated yet. That's why bridges in cold climates need major rehabilitation every 30 to 40 years. The concrete looks fine from the outside, but inside, the rebar is quietly turning to rust and expanding.
Yet the Pantheon in Rome has been standing for 1900 years. That's not a myth.
That's Roman concrete, which is a completely different animal. The Romans used volcanic ash, pozzolana, mixed with lime and seawater. Over centuries, that mixture reacts to form a rare mineral called aluminum tobermorite, which actually gets stronger over time. It's self-healing in a way that modern concrete isn't. When cracks form, water seeps in and triggers new crystal growth that fills the cracks. Our concrete just sits there and slowly carbonates.
We lost the recipe for immortal concrete and replaced it with something that has a shelf life.
We didn't exactly lose it. We understand the chemistry now. But Roman concrete takes months or years to reach full strength, and modern construction demands concrete that sets in hours or days. Portland cement was optimized for speed, not longevity. The trade-off was deliberate.
Which brings us to the question of what comes next. If concrete is responsible for 8% of global CO2 emissions, and it doesn't even last forever, there's a pretty strong case for finding alternatives.
The alternative getting the most attention right now is mass timber, specifically cross-laminated timber, or CLT. It's made by gluing layers of wood at right angles and pressing them into massive panels. The Ascent Tower in Milwaukee, completed in 2022, is 25 stories and 284 feet tall, the tallest timber building in the world. It used a concrete core for lateral stability against wind, but the floors and columns are all mass timber.
25 stories of wood. That feels like it shouldn't work.
It works because CLT is engineered to be strong in both directions, kind of like plywood at architectural scale. It's about 1/5 the weight of concrete, which means the foundations can be smaller. It sequesters carbon rather than emitting it. The Ascent saved about 2,400 metric tons of CO2 compared to a steel and concrete equivalent. And it can be prefabricated with CNC precision, so panels arrive on site with openings for windows and conduit already cut. But it cost about 15% more. And that's the pattern across most markets. Mass timber runs 10 to 20% more expensive than concrete. It also has real technical limitations. Wood burns, so fire protection strategies are more complex. It's lighter, which sounds like an advantage, but lighter buildings sway more in the wind. You have to design for occupant comfort, not just structural safety. And moisture management during construction is critical. If CLT panels get soaked before the building is enclosed, they can warp or develop mold.
It's not a drop-in replacement. What about geopolymer concrete?
Geopolymer concrete replaces Portland cement with industrial waste products like fly ash or slag. It can cut CO2 emissions by 50 to 80%, and in some formulations, it's actually more resistant to chemicals and high temperatures than traditional concrete. The catch is that it's finicky. It sets more slowly, requires precise temperature control during curing, and the supply chain for fly ash is shrinking as coal plants close. It's a brilliant technical solution with a narrowing window of raw material availability. Hempcrete is fascinating, but it's not a structural material. You mix the woody core of hemp stalks with lime, and it creates a lightweight carbon-negative insulator. Great for walls and low-rise buildings, but its compressive strength is a tiny fraction of concrete's. You still need a structural frame, wood or steel, to carry the loads. Hempcrete is an insulation replacement, not a concrete replacement.
The real frontier might not be replacing concrete entirely, but making concrete itself greener.
That's where most of the serious money is going. Carbon-cured concrete injects captured CO2 into the mix during curing, where it mineralizes and becomes permanently trapped. Recycled aggregate reduces the need for new gravel mining. Cement substitutes, limestone calcined clay, for example, can cut the Portland cement content by up to 50% without sacrificing strength. These aren't exotic lab experiments anymore. They're being used in commercial projects right now. But the construction industry is famously conservative, and for understandable reasons. When a building fails, people die. The Sampoon collapse wasn't an experiment with a novel material. It was a failure of known materials used badly. Convincing developers and insurers to trust a new concrete formulation that hasn't been field tested for 30 years is a hard sell. Concrete costs about $100 to $150 per cubic yard delivered. For a typical 10-story building, it's still the cheapest way to get the compressive strength you need. Mass timber and geopolymer alternatives aren't just competing on performance, they're competing against a material that's been optimized for cost over a century.
We're stuck with concrete for a while.
We're stuck with it because it works, it's cheap, and everyone in the supply chain knows how to use it. The shift will come. It has to, given the emissions, but it'll be incremental. Better concrete first, then alternative structural systems where they pencil out economically, then maybe a regulatory tipping point.
All of this raises a practical question. You're standing in a concrete building right now. What should you actually be looking at?
or more precisely, the signs that the rebar is in trouble. The concrete itself is almost certainly fine. It's the steel inside that's the ticking clock. When carbonation reaches the rebar, or when chlorides penetrate from road salt or sea air, the steel starts rusting. And rust expands to 2 to 4 times the volume of the original steel.
You look for rust stains bleeding through the concrete. Those orange-brown streaks on columns, or the underside of beams.
That's the first warning sign. The second is spalling, chunks of concrete flaking off, exposing the rebar underneath. You see this a lot in parking garages, especially near joints where water pools. Once the rebar is visible and rusted, the structural integrity is already compromised. It's not an emergency in most cases. Buildings don't collapse without warning, but it's something that needs a structural engineer's attention. Expansion joints, construction joints, anywhere 2 pores of concrete meet, those are the weak points in the moisture barrier. If you're in an older concrete building and you see rust stains radiating from a joint, that's carbonation working its way inward.
Here's another one. Next time you walk past a construction site, look at the columns. The ones on the ground floor versus the ones going in at the top. The difference in size is the gravity load path made visible.
It's one of those things you never notice until someone points it out, and then you can't unsee it. A skyscraper under construction is basically a diagram of its own structural logic. The columns at the base are massive, several feet across, and as you look up, they step down in size at regular intervals. Each reduction corresponds to a point where the accumulated load drops enough that you can shed some cross-sectional area. You're literally watching the load pyramid being built from the bottom up.
If you see a building where the columns don't taper, where they're the same size at the top as at the bottom, that usually means either the architect decided the visual uniformity was worth the extra concrete cost, or the building uses a structural system where the loads are distributed differently, like a tube structure where the exterior frame carries most of the weight.
Third thing, and this is the one that makes you feel like you have X-ray vision. When you're in a high-rise, look for the expansion joints. They're those vertical gaps in the walls or floor, usually filled with a flexible sealant, sometimes covered by a metal plate. They run the full height of the building in long structures. The building is designed to move. Thermal expansion and contraction, wind sway, seismic drift. If you rigidly connect a 300-foot-long building, a 50-degree temperature swing can make it grow or shrink by more than an inch. That force has to go somewhere, and if there's no joint to absorb it, it goes into the concrete as stress.
The expansion joint is a controlled weak point, a pressure release valve for the entire structure.
Here's the thing you can actually observe. If you see an expansion joint that's compressed, where the sealant is bulging out, or one that's torn open wider than it should be, that means the building is moving more than the engineers anticipated. Could be thermal, could be settlement, could be something structural. Either way, it's worth noting.
That's the kind of detail that makes you walk through a building differently. You stop seeing walls and start seeing systems.
Which brings us to the broader point. The construction industry is on the cusp of a materials revolution, but revolutions in this industry happen in slow motion. The technology for mass timber high-rises exists. Low-carbon concrete formulations exist. Geopolymer alternatives exist. What doesn't exist in most places is a building code that lets you use them at scale without an expensive, project-specific fight with the permitting authority.
The most impactful thing an ordinary person can do is not about choosing materials. It's about supporting code updates.
When your city or state proposes updating the building code to allow taller mass timber buildings or to permit carbon-cured concrete as an approved alternative, those public comment periods matter. The technology is ready. The economics are getting closer. The bottleneck is the regulatory framework, and that framework moves when people push it.
It's a weird form of civic engagement, showing up to a zoning board meeting to say you want them to approve cross-laminated timber. But that's how the Pantheon got built too. Someone had to convince the powers that be that volcanic ash and lime would hold up a dome.
1900 years later, it's still standing. The next generation of buildings won't use Roman concrete, but they might use materials we're only now learning to take seriously. The question that sticks with me is whether we'll ever see a 100-story mass timber building. The engineering isn't the obstacle. We can calculate the loads, design the connections, manage the fire risk with encapsulation and sacrificial layers. The real question is whether the economics and the building codes will ever align to make it happen.
100 stories of wood. It sounds like something out of a fairy tale.
It sounds that way because we've spent a century equating height with steel and concrete. But the ascent at 25 stories proved the concept works at scale. Every doubling of height brings new challenges. Wind behavior gets nonlinear, connections have to handle bigger forces, but none of it is physically impossible. It's a cost problem and a regulatory problem, not a physics problem. And cost problems have a way of solving themselves when the alternative gets expensive enough. If carbon taxes or material shortages make concrete less viable, mass timber starts looking like a bargain. Or if someone builds a 50-story timber tower and the insurance data comes back clean. That's what the industry is waiting for. Not a white paper, but a building that's been standing for 20 years with no surprises.
Every building you walk into is a testament to thousands of years of incremental engineering knowledge. The Romans figured out concrete arches and volcanic ash chemistry that we still don't fully replicate. Some 19th century French gardener figured out that iron mesh inside concrete makes flower pots indestructible, and we turned that into skyscrapers. The next generation might figure out how to build without emitting 8% of global CO2.
That's the through line. It's not about one breakthrough material that solves everything. It's about thousands of small improvements. Better curing methods, smarter foundation designs, code updates that let new materials compete. Accumulating over decades the same way the gravity load path accumulates weight, floor by floor.
If this episode made you look at buildings differently, if you're going to walk past a construction site tomorrow and actually notice the column taper, or check the expansion joints in your office lobby, share it with someone who works in construction or architecture. They'll either confirm everything we said or tell us we got it all wrong. And honestly, we'd love to hear that conversation.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, the Idomen people of Kamchatka produced a vivid red pigment by grinding dried salmon roe with volcanic clay, creating a paint used to decorate ceremonial dugout canoes. The iron oxides in the clay reacted with proteins in the roe to produce a color that resisted fading even after months of saltwater exposure.
I have so many questions, and I'm not sure I want answers to any of them.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon with whatever Daniel sends us next.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.